This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a chance today in light of this week's news that the wreckage of the USS Lexington has been found at the bottom of the Coral Sea, to hear from one of the last remaining survivors of the Lady Lex, Gordon Scott, at age 95, now enjoying life at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno. In a bit, I'm going to ask him a few what-if questions in light of that discovery by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen and his research vessel Petrel team. But when we left off, you were hearing from Gordon about that carrier's most famous fighter pilot and his legendary exploits that essentially saved the ship. Chicago's biggest airport is named after Butch O'Hare, and if you're ever there, you'll notice an F-4F Wildcat fighter plane on display, just like the one O'Hare earned a Medal of Honor in on February 20th, 1942, when he weaved his way in and out of Japanese bombers, shooting down five of them in just a couple of hours. He took just one bullet hole in his Wildcat, and O'Hare would expend all the ammunition he had. When he came back to the ship, he was mistakenly fired upon by one of the Lexington's anti-aircraft guns, like the ones you can see covered in barnacles in those images beamed back by Paul Allen's research team. For Gordon Scott and the rest of the men on the Lexington that day, what O'Hare did in the air above the ship was quite a feat.
It certainly was. When he came back aboard and landed and everything, it just unbelievable. And I'm sure he couldn't believe what he had done either.
Were you part of securing his plane when it landed?
Well, like I say, I was in V1 division, which was in the resting gear in the back. When the planes land there, they have a tail hook at the back of the plane. The resting gear cables are hydraulically controlled, and they raise up to about 10 inches. If they miss one of them, they go into barriers and crash. There's a landing signal officer in the back on the port side in the back that helps them come in and gives them the directions, whether too high or too low or whatever, and then he gives the deal to cut. Reciprocal engines before the jet engines, when a plane came in, they had to come in and fly in speed, and then when they tried to land, they actually had to cut power. And if they didn't make the deal and whatever, they'd crash. On a jet plane today, when they come in, they land and hit the throttle full speed, and if they miss, they can take off and go back around. But the carrier decks now are slanted instead of straight away like they used to be.
You mentioned O'Hare coming back, and it was unbelievable. Was there some celebration on the ship?
Yes, there was. I don't think he realized what he had done either. There was a lot of celebration because it was quite a feat, and it was early in the war, too.
He was the first Navy pilot to become an ace and then the first to win a Medal of Honor, and he won it for that day.
That's right, and he was then brought back to the United States and, I shouldn't say paraded around, but went around with the morale for the people back here, what had happened and everything, and selling more war bonds and so forth. But it was the same kind of a deal that they brought back the people that raised the flag at Iwo Jima, brought all those boys back home too.
And how did that play on the ship? I imagine some guys might say, hey, that guy just kind of saved our ship by shooting down five Japanese bombers. We need that guy. Keep him here.
Yeah, that's right. He came back later as a skipper of a fighter squadron.
Yes, he did. He was in charge of all the different planes flying off the carrier USS Enterprise, and on a night fighter mission in an F-6F Hellcat on November 26, 1943, O'Hare was shot down. His body was never found. His plane was never found. Before the end of the war, the Navy had named a destroyer for him, and Butch O'Hare remains one of the more well-known of the more than 405,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. And I bring that up with you, Gordon, because you and all the other veterans I interview always tell me that the real heroes of World War II are those that never came home. Butch O'Hare, of course, one of those. And what impression did he make on you during your time together on the Lexington?
I didn't have a lot to do with him, but he was a very humble person. I mean, it wasn't a guy that, you know, blowing that he had done this and everything. It was an unbelievable feat.
Yes, sir, without question. You know, I have some links to more information on Butch O'Hare if you visit hometownheroesradio.com. But let's get back to your story, Gordon. What was next for you and the Lady Lex?
Well, from there, we got back in and back to Pearl Harbor. And I think it was somewhere about 113 days or something like that that we'd been at sea. And we came back in and refueled and went back to sea. We didn't realize it at the time, but in March, when we attacked at Solomon and Leia in New Guinea, that was on the west side of New Guinea, and we went around to the eastern side and there was a pass in the mountains there that was the planes that we had then, the service ceiling, which you could actually wouldn't go above that, or would be pretty hard to go above it, could go through this pass, and they went through and bombed the ships, and they sank several of their ships, and probably stopped the, in fact, Australia never forgot it. I mean, they thought that would have been a stepping stone of invading Australia. At one of the reunions we had in Alex, one of the last ones, they even sent a representative from Australia thanking us. I mean, it was quite unbelievable. But that was stopping the Japanese from really getting into Australia. They had to fly through this pass in New Guinea and then bomb them and then get back before the cloud formations closed the pass off. So it was pretty well timed.
A couple months later, you guys would be looking for someone to save you. What do you remember about May 7th, 1942 and the day that followed?
Some of our scout planes sighted the Japanese fleet and carriers and cruisers, battleships, and everything. We sent planes and attacked them and sank one carrier and damaged another one. And then the next day, our planes were going back and attack them again. They had spotted us in the meantime. In mid-flight, here was a fleet from the care of their carriers coming back to attack us. And they passed each other going, we're going to attack them and they're coming to attack us. Well, they got to us about 11 o'clock in the morning. They came in with dive bombers and torpedo planes. We took one torpedo hit on the port side and took two bomb hits, one in the superstructure on the starboard side and another bomb hit on one of the gun stations on the port side. There was a lot of damage, but our planes came back, and we had never had over an 8-degree list on the ship, and we landed, got back into the wind to land our planes that were coming back from attacking them, and landed our planes back, didn't land all of them, but we landed the ones that were there. Then they were refueling our planes to go back for another attack, and apparently it had ruptured some gasoline lines internally in the ship and was spewing gas out. That's very high octane gas, and it started burning up inside. And indirectly, the Japanese didn't sink us from their bomb hits or torpedo hits, but our ship burned up. That was at 11 something in the morning, and we didn't abandon ship till 5:18 that night.
And you're describing that, and I'm thinking, what did that look like? What did that feel like? And as you described, you still had to land your plane, so you're still there at your duty station, and your ship is damaged and on fire. Let's start here, maybe. Can you help us understand what that felt like when the torpedo and those bombs hit the Lexington?
I was about the what we call the barrier cables that stop the planes if they're going to crash. Needless to say, people say they're not scared. I think they're damn liars. But was back right by the superstructure. And when we were attacked, pretty good jolt when you get a torpedo hit and a bomb hit, or one of the bomb hits in the superstructure right above us where we were. And I don't know, it's quite a feeling. It's hard to explain, really. We would send crews down fighting the fire internally. In the Navy, from when the ship was first built, I think they painted every week for an inspection. And I don't know how thick the paint was on the metal between and all the compartments, but they had doors that you could call them, dog them down with latches on them and close them like locking a door in a house. It would get so hot on one side, it would start paint burning on the other side. So literally, that just went from compartment to compartment and dogging them down, burning, crews going down. Then people more and more began coming up on the flight deck. We had a little over 2,000 people aboard the ship. I don't know if there wasn't 2,000 up there because there were still people going down and fighting the deal. And just waiting, I mean, a period of waiting, that was from 11 to 5 o'clock that night, just laying there, just ship burning up internally. People would get a little scared, and they'd take life rafts, rubber life rafts that were in the planes, and inflate them, throw them over the side, and there's quite a bit of current in the ocean. And these life rafts would just float away. One of the deals that I think it was, if I remember right, it was probably 5:18 that night when they told us to abandon ship. I'll never forget it. There was a destroyer that came alongside, and I went down. I was in the water and got picked up by the destroyer. I looked up, and here was a guy that was one of the squadron. We called him Porky Pref. He was in the torpedo squadron. Had inflated a big three-man or five-man life raft, and he tied a line to his wrist and another one to the raft and had some guys throw it over the side. Well, I was down on the destroyer, just got picked up, And I looked up, and here he come. He forgot how far it was to the water, and that the raft got down to the water before he did. And it, and I never seen the guy again for several years.
So you weren't in the water all that long? You got picked up quickly?
Got picked up and was later transferred to a cruiser, the USS Portland, transferred to a cruiser. And we were black from smoke and kind of sick and scared and everything else. And it was then starting to get dark, and we just laid down in one of the compartments of the ship. And cruisers have a couple seaplanes that they send up in scouting for the cruisers. That morning they shot one off, and we thought, my God, here we go again, someone's bombing the ship. But they had just shot one of the cruiser planes off.
So the Lexington went down there in May of 1942, and obviously you survived, and a lot were able to get off. You talked about the abandoned ship. When did you realize how many fellow sailors you lost that day?
We ended up in the Tonga Islands. We were in Tonga Tabu in the Tonga group. Tonga is several different islands. When we were there, well, there was a hospital ship there. So a lot of our people were injured, went there, and several of them even died afterwards on the hospital ship. And a lot of people had to stay there. The rest of us were put on a transport that was in Tonga. We stopped back at Pearl Harbor and picked up some Marines that had been going back to the U.S. We came back to San Diego. We pulled in what they called a destroyer base. It's in the south from downtown San Diego, way back in the destroyer base. That was in late afternoon, and they announced that anybody that had families in San Diego could go ashore that night. Well, I had a brother that was a foreman in one of the aircraft plants in San Diego, so I got to go ashore, and went down to the aircraft plant there, and he worked on a late night shift. Went up to the security there and told him who I was, and I was dungarees and no uniform, and the guy kind of looked at me suspiciously, and he radioed in or called in on the phone and got a hold of my brother, and he came out, and he couldn't believe it. He says, "Did you desert the Navy?" We weren't supposed to tell anybody, but I had to tell him what happened, and we got back later. They issued us clothing and everything the next day and got us all straightened out. Got to come back home to Kingsburg and still hadn't said anything. I was walking down the streets here in Kingsburg when it came back and out in the news, and there was a fellow here from the Kingsburg Recorder newspaper that hunted me down and wanted to know what happened.
Your ship's been sunk. Your brother doesn't know about it. Nobody knows about it. But here all of a sudden you are, and they're wondering why. That had to be a pretty surreal kind of stretch of time there.
Yeah, it was. It was quite a deal. But I was fortunate. I got to come back to Kingsburg for a short time. Went back to San Diego after about 3 or 4 weeks. There's six of us. They divided us up in different sections. At first they tried to see if we couldn't get another carrier that was being built or about ready to get out of building. And rename it the Lexington and put the whole crew on it, but they couldn't do that. So they divided our V1 division, which was the resting gear on the carrier, and they sent six of us to the Naval Air Station and shipyards in Philadelphia. And they were just starting a training school there. They were building so many Jeep carriers and other carriers at that time, they didn't have people trained really to man the deals. So they were setting up a deal, and they used the six of us for a while there in the training program to set it up. And then after about possibly a month, we were transferred to Norfolk, Virginia, to the naval base there. Went aboard another carrier, the USS Sewanee. And after a short time, we went out to sea, had a group of new pilots qualifying. Some of them hadn't been landing on carriers. That was an experience, too, because there was a lot of accidents. And then after maybe a week or two, we got left out of there and went to Bermuda. Then we done the same thing. We came out of Bermuda and trained more pilots, landing more. We had a catapult on this carrier, launching planes and landing them back and training everybody on the ship. And might say that basically, by and large, the biggest percentage of the personnel on the ship had never been to sea before. We had one experience to show the lack of training. They had a plane hooked up on a catapult, and we were going to sea, and it sounded flight quarters. And this plane, normally you would never hook a plane up on the catapult. You put what they call a bridle up on the plane and attach it to the catapult. And this was all hooked up there. And I was there talking to one of the guys that was with us, leaning against the plane, and turned and went to the bridge just adjacent to us. And I heard a click, and I turned around, and Here this plane had been fired off of the catapult and mowing people down, going down the deal. No one in the plane, and the plane wasn't turning up, and it was terrible. This friend of mine that had been there, the plane just run right over him. He'd hurt his back real bad, and he was in the hospital for a long time and killed quite a few people and maimed a lot of people. And it was a terrible accident.
Again, I'm struck by something you said there. You said you had just walked away right before. If you had still been standing where you were, what would have happened to you?
That's right. I mean, I've been very lucky. And still am.
And we're blessed to have the opportunity to visit with Gordon Scott, one of our last living connections to that ship discovered this week at the bottom of the Coral Sea. More from Gordon when we come back, including what belongings of his are still on the USS Lexington way down there under the ocean. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.